This is American Fashion Podcast. I'm Charles Beckwith. You're with Kathy Sheppes.
Hi, everyone.
And we're in a loft in Tribeca, and it's New York Fashion Week, and somebody's in town. Natalie Channon is here. Hi.
Hi.
Natalie, your line is called Alabama Channon, and it's kind of famous largely because you were a leader in the slow fashion movement. Can you describe what slow fashion is? How do you think about it?
Well, you know, we first started talking about slow fashion kind of as a derivative of the slow food movement. I think, you know, in many ways that that industry is light years ahead of where fashion is. So, you know, people started really looking at the way things were planted and grown much sooner than we did with textiles. So, I think a lot of what's being done around, you know, sustainable fashion is really taking cues from that movement.
What made you start your own line? Actually, let's just go back. What's your background in the fashion business and textiles and all these things?
That's a really good question. Well, I have a degree in what's called environmental design from North Carolina State University, which you know, sounds very modern today, but really it was a degree that was kind of based on Bauhaus education. So I did a double major that today is called the Annie Albers program. So I had a degree in like design fundamentals and textile design, sort of handmade textile design. And then I have another degree in industrial textile design. So
At North Carolina State University, what are the other degrees other than in the environmental design? So if you're doing environmental design, what are you not doing?
Yeah, so I think the structure there is a little bit different now.
When you were there?
When I was there, it started out, you either signed into textile design, product design, graphic design, architecture, and landscape.
So environmental design is really cross-disciplinary of all of those.
Correct. It was sort of modeled after the Bauhaus wheel of learning. You know, I think a lot of people know that when the Bauhaus designers left Germany, some of them settled in the mountains of North Carolina in a place called Black Mountain. And I think that was very influential in the School of Design, which is now called the College of Design at NC State.
So, oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay.
So
how did you get into the fashion business after you left school?
Well, that's a really good question. I just imagined when I graduated from NC State, because that was kind of the cradle of the textile industry at that time, that I would have been working in Charlotte or, you know, somewhere around North Carolina. There were quite a few factories and, you know, and a lot of textiles being made in that area while I was in school. And, you know, I graduated in 87, and it was sort of the beginning of the great migration, or let's call it the next migration, because textiles are pretty migratory. It's a pretty migratory industry. So when I graduated, I had a really hard time finding a job in North Carolina. And back in those days, you had to go to the library, and there were books that listed all the companies that were working in textiles in New York. And so I sent off about 60 letters, and, you know, I got like five responses, and I came up to New York for a week and did some interviews. And at the end of the week, I got an offer from a company called Juju, so Junior Sportswear, Macy's, third floor, right? I think it was the third floor. You know, the tagline was "Do you juju?" So it was like a jeans and t-shirt company. And I started out there just as an assistant designer and went from there.
And how did you come to the point where you started your own line?
You know, it's kind of a roundabout story. After Juju, I worked for a company called Substudio that was doing all the manufacturing and samples in India. So I spent some time going back and forth between New York and India. And after I stopped doing that job, I actually sort of changed the focus and became a stylist. So working on the other side of the camera, you know, instead of on the design and manufacturing side, I was doing costume design. And so I did that for a decade. And during a sabbatical that I was taking from my life as a stylist, I wound up, you know, cutting apart some t-shirts and sewing them back together again by hand. And it led down this path that eventually, you know, became a business. So, very crazy story.
And what led you to Florence, Alabama, to have a headquarters for your business?
Well, Florence is my hometown. So, it took me a while to kind of figure out this when I was sewing the t-shirts in the beginning that, you know, actually what I was doing looked very much like a quilting stitch. And so I was living in New York on 23rd Street and at the Chelsea Hotel. And I started going around the garment district looking for, you know, embroiderers to kind of help me do this. I had this vision of having these 200 one-of-a-kind t-shirts. I was buying recycled t-shirts, you know, from the Salvation Army and Goodwills. And, you know, I always make the joke, I think some of these places thought I was a bag lady, you know, would come in with like these bags of recycled t-shirts cut up. And I wanted them to put these kind of elaborate embroideries on them. And you know, they were like, lady, no. And so, I mean, I remember very clearly the afternoon I was standing on 8th and 38th, and I looked down at one of the pieces, just kind of dumbfounded on why I couldn't figure out how to get these made in New York. And, you know, it just sort of hit me like a light bulb went off, like, oh, this is a quilting stitch. And if I want to have these made in this way that I'm sewing them, I need to go home where there were still some ladies who had quilted with my grandmother who had this little, you know, quilting circle. They would get together once a week to do these quilts. And I thought, well, if I go home, I could have these made. And so, you know, the idea was that it was just going to be a one-off project. I was going to have these t-shirts made. I wanted to make this documentary film about old-time quilting circles. So I went home and, you know, the great humor in it was that, you know, the little ladies who had quilted with my grandmother really weren't interested in New York City fashion or, you know, doing this work. And, you know, they were talking about their grandkids and planning collards and, you know, all the things that they had to do outside of the, their quilting was kind of community service work. And so we just ran, I had a random ad in a newspaper that said part-time hand sewing and quilting. And we got about, again, I think, you know, there were about 50, 60 responses and about 20 of the ladies stuck and started doing the hand sewing. And then we presented that first collection of 200 t-shirts during New York Fashion Week in February of 2001. I had a friend who became a partner and then another partner. And so we, you know, it's kind of history. The first person to come through the door was Julie Gilhart from Barney's. And, you know,
it was a big part of history, fashion history. It was like recycled couture.
Oh, thank you.
You know,
so much.
It was just one of the foremost brands to be looking at. I mean, there was such a buzz around it. It was amazing.
Thank you. And I'm ever grateful to, you know, Julie Gilhart and Sally Singer for going out into the world and telling our story and, you know, Julie sending her buyers down to us and then Vogue also telling the story again. It was a very unusual story to tell. So I know everybody sort of took a risk and went out on the limb with us. And so, you know, the funniest part was, is that they were kind of intended as one of a kind pieces. And so when the buyers from Barney's came back, they were like, we'll have 12 like this, 12 like this, and 12 like this. And I was like, wait a minute. These are, you know, one of them said like Smith Family Reunion, Roanoke, Virginia. You know, I was like, I can't get 12 just like that. And they said, oh, just do something similar and in a similar color. We had been doing a lot of overdyeing as well. And so I went back home to, you know, I was actually not even living in Florence. I was in a little like country town right about 10 miles outside of Florence. So I went back to Central. Well, actually, I called the ladies from New York and I said, you know, what do you guys think? Would, you know, do you want to do more of this? And yes. And so I went back home and set up production and we shipped Barney's within 3 months. You know, we went back and did a little quick turnaround and we shipped Barney's and they called back in about 3 weeks that they had sold almost all of the t-shirts and, you know, where's fall? So it went from being like a one-off, you know, project to being a collection that 20 years later, we're, you know, still there, still sewing. Some of the original ladies are still sewing with us.
Your brand is still here, but Barney's isn't. That must be strange to come back to New York City and Barney's is gone.
You know, I hadn't really thought about that, but yes, that's true.
Now Nordstrom can take its place, I think, because I think they're doing a lot of things that are so progressive with
wonderful
brands and direct-to-consumer brands, and they're trying new brands. It's something to keep in mind.
I love that. Mm.
You've moved well beyond t-shirts now, but you still have hand sewing going on in Alabama. What would you say is the core of the current brand of what Alabama Channon stands for as a brand?
I mean, that hand sewing and that commitment to community and economic development is definitely, you know, at the core of our brand. I mean, hand sewing and this, you know, quilting stitch, if you call it, is really what launched our brand, and it's still a core part of that. Just in the last few years, we were very lucky to be able to collaborate with one of the great makers during the when textiles in North Alabama and across the southern region were at its pinnacle. And so we put some machines back in this plant where our studio, we called the factory, is now. And we started making machine-made garments, sort of basics, using organic cotton, I guess about 5 years ago, and 5 to 6 years ago. And so now there's this kind of beautiful conversation between handmade and machine-made. We have some things that are really completely handmade in the old way of us doing things. And then we have these beautiful, completely machine-made pieces. And then there are some pieces that require both. And so
and do those workers kind of ever have the opportunity to work together, or are the hand workers working only out of their home?
So the hand workers are working from their home or their place of business. They're independent contractors, so they do not work on site. We use kind of a very beautiful and elaborate bidding system where they bid on particular projects, and then they take and complete those projects and then turn them back in. But we have over the years, we've had a community picnic every year where people can come together and meet one another, but they don't side by side per se.
And for the hand sewers, you have a school for them? That are you training them, or are they coming to you with that expertise?
They're coming to us with the expertise. So we do have a division of the company called the School of Making now, but that's more for people who just want to learn how to hand sew. So,
and you give them the components to do that, right, in the school?
Both. So our artisans also get the components. So they buy the raw materials from us to create a project and then sell us the finished goods. And in the School of Making, someone might say they want to make a skirt, and they could get all the components to be able to make the skirt and then just do the hand sewing themselves. We have books that, you know, were kind of part of our mission statement as well. So, you know, after I had been home for a while, it really was very starkly clear that some of these you know, hand sewing techniques were being lost. And so, you know, we started talking about not only sustainability in terms of using recycled and organic materials, but in terms of cultural sustainability as well, like how you preserve craft, how you preserve techniques, how you're sure that, you know, you could even go so far as to call it survival skills are passed from one generation to the next. And so the books that we wrote about this sewing methods kind of came out of this idea of trying to preserve some of the things that were very, you know, ubiquitous when I was growing up, but maybe less so by the time I came back to do this work.
I was thinking about that a while ago. I couldn't get anybody to invest in the project, but I wanted to get one of the 3D video cameras and just record the hand movements of people here in the garment district doing handwork, because they're, you know, in their 60s and 70s, they're not going to be doing it for much longer. And there's nobody young in the shops with them.
Yeah.
So there's techniques that are literally thousands of years old for how you move your hands to make something that will be lost in this generation. It's crazy.
We've found that even with the machine work. So, you know, in our factory, it was a sewing plant. There was a dye house in there, I think some knitting machines as well. But after we brought the sewing machines back in, you know, you forget that NAFTA began in 94. I mean, it's been quite a time that most of those factories have been closed down. So even just how to sew a t-shirt on a machine in a proper way, there were very few people left who were part of that. And, you know, part of that system at that time was more a production line. So, you know, someone might have been a hemmer, or they would have set sleeves or just done the collars. And so being able to make a t-shirt from beginning to end was a very unusual skill. And so we really relied on some elders in the community to come in and teach us, like retrain us for how to make sewing a great t-shirt on a machine. And, you know, one of the things so spurred me on, I'm sorry, this is a long story, but
please, that's what we do.
you know, we found there are no videos that showed. So when we were having trouble with the machines, there were no videos. There was no training manual. In some cases, the machines you couldn't even find an illustration for how to thread the machine. Right. So we had to go in and do illustrations. And one of our great employees had an iPhone, and she would film the mechanic doing these little moves, like to put this one particular piece on. You have to kind of take it and go to make it work. And if you didn't do this little movement, then the machine didn't work. And so they use these videos to train people on how to get these attachments and things on so that they would be able to do the work. So.
And your education efforts have been beyond local. You have people come in for Summit and other things.
Yeah, from all over the world, really. We've had people from every continent come to learn with us. So, yeah, education has been a really big part of our mission statement. You know, in part, just carrying on this craft that, you know, really flourished in our region. We're also looking at like the history of textiles. I think a lot of that hasn't been documented. You know, we started trying to understand what our region looked like when it was, as I mentioned, the pinnacle of the textile industry. Like what was the racial balance of the workers? What did the economics look like? And there's just not a lot of data about it. And so it's very hard to judge where we are today, not knowing what came before. And so we started a 501c3 not-for-profit called Project Threadways that really, you know, tries to look at that time, but not only that time. I mean, let's face it, we're working with cotton in the South in Alabama, and you don't have to look back very far to find a very ugly history. And, you know, there are conversations that I think have been avoided, you know, because it's another time and this is today. But I don't think that we can work with cotton in the South and not at least try to have those conversations, you know. And I say to people all the time, you're going to find my foot in my mouth a lot. Just, you know, help me figure out a way to get it out of my mouth and, you know, back on the ground. And maybe we can walk this walk together to try to, you know, at least look at what that history is. And, you know, the really interesting thing about it is we have a symposium in April. So our symposium this year is April 16th to 18th. And it's really about the long arc of time because, you know, textiles in the South didn't start, you know, at the pinnacle and the signing of NAFTA. It didn't start, you know, with large cotton plantations and the enslaved. It started well before then. And so I'm really trying to look at the beginnings, Native Americans and you know, there's evidence to show that there was cotton already being grown in the region and what that looks like up until today and what the future could look like. And I think you interviewed Dana Thomas with her book.
Yeah.
So, you know, Dana's coming back to kind of help us look at the future. So what is this long arc of textiles? What mistakes, you know, what happened? What mistakes were made in all their, you know, ugly and beauty and, you know, everything that can be understood? And then what does it look like to move into the future with a, you know, with a sustainable brand and working in a way that is better than it was in the past?
Yeah. So you had also won in 2013 the CFDA Lexus.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Award.
Very grateful for that.
So what's the name of that award?
The CFDA Lexus
Eco-Fashion Challenge.
Eco-Fashion Challenge.
So how did that help you? I mean, and do they, it, what kind of support did that give you? Or what kind of awareness did that give you that you didn't have before?
Yeah, it was amazing. So yeah, we were, that was really wonderful. I was just talking with someone today about it. That same year that we won that, we also won the Eileen Fisher Women in Business Award. And this was a time when we were, you know, there's a lot of talk about supply chain around sustainability today. And there have been some really bumpy roads. You know, there were some years where we had to purchase all of our supply of cotton in advance. Right? A year in advance, because you have to commit to what the farmers are growing. And like, I always try to give people a perspective about it. Like, imagine Toyota or any car company had to purchase all of the metal that they need in one lump sum. You know, that is a huge commitment. And it was very, very difficult. And so the Eco Challenge, for example, helped us invest in our supply chain, which made us an even better sustainable company. And once we were able to really invest in that supply chain, our suppliers also start believing more in us and are willing to work with us. And so it gives us even more opportunity to grow that. So it was a very critical moment in the shaping of the business, both Eileen Fisher and the
right.
CFDA
and you were lucky
Lexus.
To have that
yeah.
opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of what they're talking about is, you know, is how you speak of yourself being sustainable, but you have to have real transparency and understand exactly what's going on at every aspect of your mm-hmm. supply chain.
And I mean, we're really vigilant, you know, about, you know, we know our farmers, we work with our converters, you know, we're very hands-on, and even sometimes things fall through the cracks. So it just really takes a lot of vigilance. And at the same time, we were also talking about this earlier today, I think that there's never been a time when, as an end user, you have more opportunity to really dig in and find out if a company really is being true to their mission, right? So it's ever more important for a company like ours that really wants to commit to this mission and the commitment to sustainability. I mean,
well, and I think it's important that you say to what degree you are getting there and maybe not position yourself as, you know,
the
100%.
Answer.
Yeah, and 100% sustainable. Because even talk about zero waste.
Mm-hmm.
and what does that mean to you? And how is that accomplished, and is that scalable?
I mean, zero waste is very difficult. This is, you know, these are conversations we have all the time. And I think you're right. You know, you have to, it's not enough to look at just material supply or, you know, is the company sustainable in that you're building jobs that people, you know, our staff 20 years from now can count on having that job. That's another way to look at sustainability. So is there economic sustainability in the business that we're building? Is there cultural sustainability in that we're contributing to our community and to the culture of our community? Is there, you know, zero waste? Like, what does that look like? So for us, it looks like, you know, there is a lot of wastage when you cut textiles. We practice lean method manufacturing, which is very unusual in our industry, in that we don't make anything besides our samples and a very small amount of store stock until an order is placed. So that helps, of course, reduce the amount of waste that gets us closer to zero waste. But then, as anyone who works in textiles knows, there's a, you know, there are definitely offcuts that come out of the fabric because humans aren't rectangular and we don't make only rectangular clothing. You know, there are offcuts. So we try to find ways to use those offcuts to, you know, bring them back into the product chain. So, you know, and then after that, there's, we like, on our website at the School of Making, we sell bags of scraps, you know, and these are like the leftover pieces that can't go anyplace else. And so we hope that, you know, other makers can use them to bring them into some other form. So, you know, it's something that we're always trying to find our way. But, you know, then you go, like, our building is not wind-powered or solar-powered, you know, so how... You know, there's always something more you can do.
How many people actually work at the studio?
We're always, I think we're about 23 right now in our 20s. It's always kind of fluctuates. You know, sometimes we have college students that swing in and work with us for a while. Or but right now we're around 20. And I think our artisan counts, our independent contractors, are about the same. It fluctuates anywhere between 20 and 30 at any given time. So we range from 40-ish to 65 at any given moment.
And the artisans that you are hiring, are they all different ages also?
Yes, they are. There's a wider age range now, I think, than there ever has been before. You know, some of the youngest ones are in their 20s and some of the oldest are in their 80s. So there's a pretty wide range. And reasons that people sew, you know, there's, you know, there are independent contractors who that is their only job. They sew for us and sew for others. That is what they do. And then there are, you know, mothers who have jobs and so to for some added income.
I mean, it's fascinating. And as a small independent industry, do you see that growing in other states around
this
you?
Kind of, I mean, we're not a true cottage industry method, but I guess you're talking about this cottage industry, this idea of cottage industry. I mean, I definitely think it is. I think with the, you know, like just since I started, of course, it's hard to remember that, you know, Etsy didn't really exist at that time when I started. So there's this rise of, you know, people being empowered by being connected to other, to marketplaces and people across the marketplace. So they're able to create income for their families and themselves through creative activity. Right. And so this is definitely something new and growing. And, you know, I would venture to say it's not probably in its most perfect form right now. It's still an evolving conversation. But yeah, I think you would find a lot of more people today than 20 years ago who are, you know, finding a niche for themselves like you guys and building this beautiful work from, you know, from your own creative imagination.
Well, mostly we just ask questions and people talk.
It's really fun. I walked by the UN the other day, and they are now saying there's no single-use plastic allowed on the UN premises. Mm-hmm. So I was like, wow, maybe, you know, soon it will be... no recyclable.
Oh my God! They're going to ban some of
clothing.
The ambassadors' wives.
Will be able to be worn, but you know, also then, no plastic use in the grocery stores is happening March 1st. Like, there's going to be this tremendous wake up call. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to catapult to a different level of awareness. Do you think that that will carry over onto clothing?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think that you already, again, like, let's think about the long arc of time, like 20 years. I mean, I don't think it's happening quickly enough for many of us that have been involved in sustainability. But when you go back to that long arc of time, if you think about like 20 years ago when I started to today, I mean, it's already remarkably different. And so I think you can't help but have that have a longer acting effect on the industry.
Yeah, even 6 years ago when we started this show, nobody was really talking about sustainability outside of small rooms. There weren't conferences about it. There weren't. I mean, we were the only fashion sustainability podcast I was aware of when we launched, and now there's several that talk about this topic and get into it more in more depth than we do. It's amazing how quickly things have started to reverse and head toward a more positive end, hopefully.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's happening fast enough. I wonder. I mean, Antarctica was 65 degrees this week, so that's dangerous.
Yes.
But I feel like if you just put requirements around people, but kind of help them with a wake-up call, like I am seeing people all of a sudden automatically before March 1st in grocery stores with their bags, you know, ready to not utilize plastic. And and I think it's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
And then I think about your collection and how long ago that was and how ahead of your time you were, really, and how perfect it is now. I mean, these clothes look as amazing as they did then.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Natalie, how do you approach marketing? How do you reach your customer? How do you find your customers? How do your customers find you?
Oh, this is, you know, we can do a whole podcast just on this. You know, we have this conversation weekly in our studio. You know, I think there's not one answer now. I mean, I think the landscape is changing every week and every month. And so we just, in the same way that we're vigilant about, you know, our issues of sustainability and keeping on top of our supply chain, we talk about marketing the same way. You know, 80% of our business is direct to consumer. So that's a pretty unusual, you know, we were also, I guess, pretty early on that wagon of reaching out. And so, you know, we've had a journal, an online journal or blog now for, I think, 14 years. So it's been around for, you know, we've been doing storytelling for a long time. And
for our listeners, we will put links to several of these things that we've talked about in the show into the show notes. So you can just click the show notes below what you're listening to and get to the different websites for these things. So we make it easy. Just keep looking at the show notes.
Thank you. So definitely that, you know, that outreach and that storytelling has been a big part of our marketing, you know, let's call it a strategy, but it seemed like kind of important to tell the story. So I do think that, you know, to show end users why it's important to use organic cotton, right? To tell the story behind our farmers, to, you know, I guess, you know, this new term, radical transparency. You know, I think we've been trying to practice that for a long time. I wouldn't necessarily call it radical, but just transparency. You know, we've tried to be very transparent and sharing stories from our independent contractors, sharing stories from our staff, you know, showing how our pieces are made. I mean, even writing books about how they're made and that sort of thing. So that has definitely been part of how we communicate with our guests. You know, we have a really lovely events programming. So we have, you know, we have a little cafe in the factory and do all kinds of dinners and invite people in. We give tours every day at 2 o'clock. So, I mean, anybody can show up any weekday at 2 o'clock and get a beautiful tour through the factory and see where your pieces are being made. So, you know, all these things just come together. I guess you would call that our marketing plan. Is that sound like a...
Is most of your direct business a combination of maybe they're finding your product and the beauty of your product online and then they're coming to see it? Because some of the techniques when you see them in person are far more impactful than when you just see them online. So how do you bridge that?
Yes. So we do, you know, like I said, we give the tours every day at 2 o'clock. I mean, you'll just randomly some days have someone who's, you know, flown from Ireland to New York and is headed to California, but just wanted to stop by on the way, you know, and see what we're doing. So, yes, we do have a lot of people come, and you're right. Photography sometimes doesn't, do the handwork justice, but, you know, trying it on and holding it there's nothing that beats that. But, you know, and we have a great sales team that, are, you know, really, I would call them our customer service force. I mean, they love the company and the product so much. So we have people who call and work with them over the phone, and they send boxes out, and, you know, we're very hands-on with all of our guests because we believe that our pieces are made for a lifetime. And so we want people to enjoy them for a lifetime. So we want them to be thrilled with their purchase. And, you know, that's worked out for us because we have a very, very small return rate. And, you know, our team always makes it right.
And they wait, right? They wait. I mean, they have no issues with waiting for the product to be made.
I mean, you know, we live in an ever, we're all ever more like, where's my box? But yes, so some of the, especially the hand sewn pieces can take, you know, 4 to 6 weeks or even more. Like, we do quite a few wedding dresses and things like that. And so some of the wedding dresses are very, very elaborate and can take quite a long time to make. And, you know, I think people get used to it, and then they also know that it's custom made for them. So in many cases, it's the only one like that in the world, right? And so then you're worth waiting for. It's worth waiting for. So, you know, if someone orders even a simple, you know, rib t-shirt from our website, they can put in the notes that they want it 2 inches shorter, and it's really fine for us. It's no trouble for us to make it 2 inches shorter for them. And so that's a kind of service that I think is very, very different than what you might find in other similar companies.
What's next for your company? I mean, you're always adding new things. What's your next project? Yeah.
Well, we're really working on, you know, figuring out how to celebrate our 20-year anniversary. Project Threadways has definitely become a very beautiful part of the work that we're doing. We have a new book coming out in fall of 2021 to sort of celebrate this 20 years. And there was one other thing I wanted to talk about. Oh, this very wonderful thing is happening that we're collecting our archives together. So 20 years of archives and working with an organization in the state of Alabama called the Alabama Archives to come up with a way to preserve the work of the company. And hopefully, you know, in the coming years, have a beautiful retrospective of the work. So those are all pretty big things,
yeah,
right?
That's amazing.
Sounds wonderful. Well, I hope you have a good fashion week here and you get lots of sales.
Oh, thank you. It's been great already. And thank you guys for coming up and your busy schedules.
Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to American Fashion Podcast. On our website, AmericanFashionPodcast.com, you can find our Be a Guest form, as well as a sign-up page for invitations to our live shows, and a new feature, the archives. With roughly 250 episodes published, the old shows don't fit in our feed anymore, so we've made them available for a nominal fee. Please continue the conversation online. On Twitter, we are at AFPOD, and on Instagram, we are at American Fashion Show, and I personally am at Fashion Tech Guru on just about everything. For direct comments, give us a call at 646-979-8709. That's our voicemail line. Or email info@AmericanFashionPodcast.com. American Fashion Podcast is produced by Mouth Media Network, which holds the copyright to this and all other episodes, all rights reserved. Subsist, friends. Keep making things beautiful. Remain in force. I'm Charles Beckwith, and we'll talk to you again next week.
This is Mouth Media Network, audio for business.